based on the determination that Ms. Rios was not disabled from performing the duties of her own occupation. And the timing of the claim denial here is pivotal. That claim was denied less than 3 months into the policy's own occupation period of disability, and well before the transition into the any gainful occupation definition of disability, which would not have occurred until 24 months of benefits had been paid. The district court committed clear error when it took it upon itself to make a determination in the first instance on the any occupation claim.
Is that a fact? Clear error is not the standard, is it?
I'm sorry?
I mean, clear error is not the standard. That's not the standard for reviewing facts. This isn't a fact. It's an abuse of discretion standard, probably, or maybe a legal question, but it's not a clear error standard.
The district court abused its discretion in taking it upon itself to evaluate and adjudicate a claim in the first instance under a new standard of disability that had not been determined by the claim administrator. And the district court's decision to do that and the refusal to remand that claim to the claim administrator is in direct conflict to ERISA's comprehensive statutory scheme. And that scheme provides the rights and obligations of claim fiduciaries and participants, and it provides that claim administrators, not the courts, are the appropriate entity to evaluate disability claims in the first instance.
Is that really the problem here, or is the problem that because that the record in the case doesn't cover the relevant time period? If it had covered the relevant time period, in other words, if there were material in the record from the relevant time in 2020, then presumably the district judge, because it was de novo anyway, could have decided it, but there actually isn't, is there?
You're correct. The record is incomplete for making any occupation determination, because again, the record closed in this case in April 2019 when the final determination was made. And the any occupation transition date was 15 months later in July 2020.
When was the trial? What was the trial held before Judge Carter? What month?
The trial before Judge Carter was in, I think it was late 2020. I want to say November.
So by that time, the any occupation date had kicked in, and I guess like part of what I understand the plaintiff to be saying is that, well, you know, we had the any occupation claim on the table all the way along, and you could have put in evidence about that if you wanted to.
Fair enough, but remember, Your Honor, that an ERISA case is based upon the record, and the record closed when the final determination was made, and that was in April 2019.
That was in 2019. Okay.
Exactly. And in fact,
like you didn't have any medical records then from April 2019 through whatever the trial date was.
That is exactly correct.
But I thought when it was we all agreed that this was a de novo determination, so there could have been additional records submitted, couldn't there have been?
Well,
in the court,
discretion to consider extrinsic evidence, and in fact, it did so here in the form of the Social Security Administration awards. But the review that the court is supposed to do is a review of the decision that was made based on the record that was in front of the claim administrator at the time that record was made. So it is a closed record. And so to open up...
But it's not a closed record when it's de novo. I mean, it's a little unclear about that.
Well, to open up every case to allow claimants to submit additional records would defeat the purposes of ERISA, which are to provide quick and expedient evaluations. So
get to do discovery before the district court in this case, or was it or not?
There was no discovery, and typically in ERISA cases, there is not. So it's, again, a review of the decision made at the time the record was closed. And again, not only was the record closed in April 19, 2019, but the medical records were last updated in February 2019. So to evaluate any occupation claim that would not have become relevant were adjudicated until July 2020, the administrator would have had to do so. And the decisions based on a full and complete record. This record was clearly incomplete.
Well, so, basically what I understood the district judge to say was that it was futile because what the record did demonstrate was that she had, and I understand you contest this, but you're not contesting at the moment, disability which made her unable to perform even sedentary work, and the record also showed that this was a permanent and progressive disability, so there was essentially no chance it was going to be any different. That's what I understood him to say. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, and I do take issue with the determination that she was disabled and that the evidence
did support. But at the moment, that's not what you're doing. You can switch over
to
that.
I'll set that aside for the moment. The problem is it requires the court, without medical resources, to make a medical prognostication about what Ms. Rios' status will be 19, 15 months into the future based on incomplete medical records.
There were some doctors who said she's never going to be able to work.
There was one doctor. One doctor, and there are many reasons which I will get to why that doctor's opinion was less than credible. But there's only one doctor, Dr. Steiger, who Ms. Rios turned to after her claim was denied, who declared her to be permanently and totally disabled from all work activities. And again, there's numerous reasons why his opinions are less than credible.
Even if you accept his opinion, presumably one of the things she could have done, Ms. Rios could have done, is she could have said, okay, this is bad enough, I'm now going to go ahead and get the steroid injections, or I'm now going to go ahead and have the surgery, and maybe your condition could have improved, right?
Exactly. And spinal conditions, including herniated discs, can resolve on their own over time, or at least improve over time. But the point being that neither the courts nor claim administrators should be put in the position of having to speculate about what a person's condition will be sometime in the future. I mean, the bottom line is this: any occupation claim never became ripe, never ripened to the stage where it needed to be evaluated.
Now,
the district court,
can you tell me where in the record the Social Security Administration determination is?
It's at pages, I believe, 159 to 162.
In volume 1, volume 2, volume 2?
I believe it's volume 2, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead. One possible response to what you're saying is that that was a permanency determination, as I understand it, or not any occupation determination.
ALJ.
Yes.
There are problems with the ALJ's decision, and keep in mind that the ALJ is not required to comport with the statutory scheme work set forth in ERISA. So the ALJ is deciding sedentary capacity and work capacity, but what's clear from the ALJ's decision is that the claimant, Ms. Rios, misrepresented the her work requirements, because the ALJ's opinion is based on the assumption that her job required her to perform at a light exertional level, whereas the record in this case, including admissions by plaintiff, showed that her job was sedentary. So that's the first problem. The ALJ also misread the evidence. For example, the ALJ cited the opinion from Dr. Hahn and said Dr. Hahn testified that Ms. Rios had a two-hour sitting limitation. If you look at Dr. Hahn's note that the ALJ was referring to, he uses unusual language. He says that my patient alleges that she can't sit. So that was not a disability determination by Dr. Hahn. It was him simply recording Ms. Rios' subjective complaints. And then finally, the ALJ's determination was versus United Ag, and that's where the court discussed the futility doctrine. And it said in order to apply the futility doctrine, the court has to determine that a claim was demonstrably doomed to fail. And the court did not follow that doctrine in this case. The court took a look at Ms. Rios' claim and said, I think she would be entitled to any occupation benefits, and that's the basis for the application of the futility doctrine. But if you think about it in terms of what additional evidence would have been placed into the record that would have been developed over the 15 months between the time the record closed and the date of the any occupation transition period, it doesn't make sense. There's no basis to argue that it would have been futile for her to make an any occupation claim. And that's the standard that wasn't followed.
And she did make an any occupation. Right. She did originally make an any occupation claim, didn't she?
She did not. Her claim was for own occupation.
I thought that she just, well, the complaint in this case does make that claim, doesn't it?
The complaint does, Your Honor.
And she didn't do it anywhere in the administrative proceedings, do that.
She said she thought she was entitled to any occupation benefits in her appeal letter, but
right, that's what I just said.
Okay, I encourage the court to go back and take a look.
No, she said she thought she was, so she did make the claim. That's not the problem. The problem is that the date hadn't come up yet, and there was therefore no medical evidence about it, but she did make the claim.
She didn't go through the normal process. Her attorney said he thought she was entitled to any occupation benefits when he submitted his appeal. The claim administrator at that point in time was still well within the own occupation period. The claim administrator did not evaluate and certainly did not adjudicate the any occupation claim.
Don't you think that there could be circumstances in which somebody's condition, somebody had a horrible accident, they're a paraplegic, and or worse, or in a coma, or something terrible. It would seem sensible to conclude and to make the claim at the beginning that, you know, I'm just never getting better, and I should get both own occupation and any occupation.
Fair enough, Your Honor, but in that circumstance, the own occupation claim most likely would have been approved, and so it would have naturally progressed into the any occupation period.
Yes, but in your theory, you still would have had a second proceeding.
There would not be a second proceeding if the own occupation benefits are being paid continuously, and the claim reaches the 24-month period. The administrator will, on its own, conduct the any occupation evaluation.
Right, so that's another proceeding.
That never happened in this case.
I understand that, but
okay.
But they wouldn't say at the outset, they'd bother to do that, and they wouldn't say at the outset, yes, you're right.
Well, certainly, they would have the discretion to do so based on the nature of the claim. But low back pain, based on degenerative disc disease, does not promote that type of early evaluation of any occupation claim. And I'd like to remind the court of its decision in Saffold versus Sierra Pacific in 1996, where the court evaluated the same issue and held that where a claim enters a new phase of disability and the claim administrator has not yet evaluated that benefit claim under a new definition of disability, courts are to remand the claim to the administrator to develop the record and to make a decision in the first instance.
Was that an abuse of discretion case? That was pre-Abada.
It was, Your Honor. But it was the exact issue that's happened here, whether it's abuse of discretion or de novo. And remember, de novo still requires a decision. And so the district court didn't have a decision that it was going to review. You can't review a decision that was never made.
She made the claim, and they didn't give it to her, so it seems like they made a negative decision on it. Right.
That is reading too much. If you take a look at the appeal letter and the appeal response, it's all about the own occupation claim. They did not evaluate the any occupation claim. They couldn't have, because in order to do so, they would have had to have medical records.
Appellees, Plaintiff and Appellee. Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that under Armani, the decision of Armani, Yolanda Rios was unable to perform sedentary work. She was unable to sit more than 4 hours, and by the definition of sedentary work in Armani, she was therefore unable to perform her own occupation. She was unable to perform her regular occupation in the national economy, and she was unable to perform any sedentary work. And the decision in Armani was an any occupational disability decision. It's clear that Ms. Rios was unable to perform any sedentary work.
But why is it clear that was going to be true a year and a half later?
Why? Say it again, Your Honor.
To clear that would be true a year and a half later.
Well, because her doctor said so, Your Honor.
Yes, but I mean, there are two things about that. One is that, as Judge Cannelli indicated, it appears that she was not getting steroid shots or surgery, and there doesn't seem to be congestion, and that doesn't matter substantively, but it certainly seems quite possible that after living with this for a while, she would just change her mind about the risk factor. So we don't know, actually, whether she ever ameliorated this condition, and the insurer doesn't know that. And secondly, predictive determinations by doctors, you know, have some facility, but they're not entitled, it seems to me, to the same conclusive difference as evaluations of what's true at the time, because they're notoriously inaccurate. I mean, people say that, you know, you're going to die of cancer in 6 months, and people live 10 years. It's very difficult to rely on those things. So, and at least in my own experience, it is particularly true of lower back. So did Judge Carter do enough with regard to the analysis of the record in that regard, i.e., that it was sufficiently predictively accurate that he should make a finding of fact that she was never going to get better? Did he make find that she was never going to get better? By the way, were those findings of fact written by the plaintiff? Were Judge Carter's findings of fact written by the plaintiff?
Judge Carter's findings were what?
Written by the plaintiff. Were they written by the plaintiff? Who drafted them?
The judge ultimately, the court did.
It's a court. Write those. You didn't draft them. It looked like a party drafted. I mean, I don't think that's being done anymore, but it did look like that. Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, the plaintiff had no part in drafting the judgment. That was the court's judgment. But to get to your earlier point, Your Honor, doctors don't have a crystal ball any more than the rest of us. Okay, but based on their experience, skill, and training, they can make medical judgments. This is a prognosis in their patient's case, that to a medical certainty. It's not an absolute certainty. We all agree on that. But that's the best that we can do, a medical certainty. Okay? And the doctors that examined her, and there were 8 healthcare providers, not just one, Mr. Hicks seems to imply, but there were 8 treating providers. There were 2 orthopedists who saw her, who was once a pain specialist, who saw her. And it was a gynecologist who performed the hysterectomy in the hopes of getting her back pain better. At that time, she had both back pain and pelvic pain, and she agreed to the surgery, the hysterectomy, that was performed by Dr. Aguilera. Her back pain didn't get better. Her pelvic pain did, and that's good. But she was unable to return to work because she continued to have back pain. And it is true that the doctors that she saw suggested to her more invasive treatment options. At the time she was being treated, with opioid medication, tramadol, muscle relaxer, Flexeril, or cyclobenzaprine, it's a generic name. And she also was advised by several of her doctors to consider epidural nerve block injections into her back and to consider surgery on her back. Okay. Now, Dr. Malhez, one of the orthopedic surgeons that was seeing her, kept telling her she needs to have back surgery. But back surgery, and I think your honors have seen this in the cases before you, back surgery does not always go well. I mean, it's a tricky business. Sometimes patients are better.
Our problem right now is that we know that she made those determinations 15 or 18 months before the transition date, but we don't even really know now, at least as far as I know in the record, that as of the transition date, she hadn't had that surgery or taken the steroid shots.
And she may never have, may never elect to have that.
I understand it, but how do we know that she did? I mean, how do we know she's not walking around perfectly fine right now from this record? How did Jessica Carter know it?
Well, if there is evidence, let us say she gets benefits, and her benefits are reinstated, and let us say she's walking around fine, okay, then Uno can challenge the benefits.
How do we know that as of the transition date, she wasn't walking around just fine? And what in this record demonstrates that?
Well, we don't have contemporary records as to the transition date. What we do have, Your Honor, is we have the medical opinions of board-certified doctors.
15 months before, that she wasn't going to be walking around just fine, but the date's come and gone, and we don't know. She could be walking around just fine.
Well, would your honor have a problem if let us change the diagnosis just a little bit? Let's say she had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. No, thankfully she doesn't.
I just used the same hypothetical, but this isn't that.
Well, her doctors say she's never going to get better.
They say that, but there's something disconcerting about the fact that we could certainly. Somebody ought to want to find out as of the transition date whether she actually was fine or not.
So look, the difference between this and ALS and the difference between this and being a quadriplegic is in this situation there's some medical treatment that could be done that potentially could ameliorate this. Maybe it would work. And I think the point is that as of the transition date, there's nothing in the record that was before Judge Carter that says what her status was then. She could have changed her mind in those 15 months and decided, geez, I'm going to have this surgery after all, and maybe it went fine. Or, heck, I'm going to have the steroid injections, and maybe they resolve my pain enough so I can sit now for enough amount of time. The point is the record doesn't have anything about what her status was as of the transition date. And unlike ALS, which is something that there's no therapy you can do for it, and unlike being a quadriplegic, ditto, this is different. So how do you respond to that?
I understand your point completely, and the response is that the medical evidence, which Judge Carter accepted as showing futility, allowed him to rule on an unexhausted any occupation claim. That happens all the time. Judges, there's nothing magical about the transition thing. If the medical evidence shows that beyond a medical certainty, to a medical certainty, if the evidence shows.
So that's why he could have had evidence brought into the case here to demonstrate whether or not she was still disabled and had an unknown returned it. Either it could have been sent to the agency, to the insurance company, remanded, or perhaps it could have been tried because it was de novo in the court. But one way or another, you'd think you'd need evidence as to whether the prediction came to pass once the date and time had shown up.
Well, there was and there is evidence as of and beyond the transition date. There was extra record evidence that does show exactly what you're asking.
Well, fine, but it didn't happen, so maybe we need to remand it and let him decide to do it one way or the other, but not to do it with no record.
Well, his decision, which is entitled to an abuse of discretion standard, his decision was that there was enough evidence, medical evidence, at the time that he looked at the case, Judge Carter, that said to him that she was disabled in the future beyond the transition date, and that's how he ruled. And I think that he's entitled to an abuse of discretion standard of review. Just a final comment. I don't think that there's anything magical about the transition thing. Yes, the definition of disability changes, but under Armani, she was disabled from any occupational activity because of her sitting tolerance less than 4 hours. And she made that claim, and I must correct Mr. Hess. The record clearly shows that she made that claim of any occupational disability right from the beginning, from her complaints in arguments to the trial court, in the briefings and oral argument before the trial court, over and over again. We made the any occupational claim and presented a preponderance of the evidence that under Armani she was disabled from any occupational activity. Now,
I asked you whether you drafted the findings of fact. There's a heading in your brief that says the district court rejected Newman's proposed findings of fact and accepted those of Ms. Rios. Did you file proposed findings of fact?
Yes.
Were those the ones that were issued?
Those were the ones that the court adopted, yes.
But what you told me was not true. I asked you whether you drafted those proposed findings of fact.
I didn't understand the question. No, those proposed findings were drafted by plaintiff's counsel, and the court adopted them.
We have a longstanding rule that those are entitled to less deference when they're drafted by the party.
Well, the court's decision to adopt the plaintiff's findings, that the defense counsel also proffered its own version of the fact.
I don't think my question was at all unclear, and you assured me that it was drafted by the court, and your brief says otherwise.
I misunderstood. I apologize for that. Both sides drafted findings of fact and conclusions of law. The judge decided that he would adopt plaintiff's version and reject the Wenham's version. But to get to the point, back to the point about about argument for any occupational benefits, that happened throughout the trial, both at the beginning with the complaint and all the way through the oral argument and the briefing in the district court and the briefing to this court. That was right from the beginning, and again, I think that Armani governs this case. Now, one last point, Your Honor, if I may. That is, the policy does not require that Ms. Rios agree to surgery or invasive procedures.
Eliminate the possibility that she did.
Well, that's her decision, and she's entitled.
It's her decision, but we don't know what the decision was, and is it a Judge Carter?
She decided to pursue conservative treatment, which one of her is a lady that had tri-level degenerative arthritis and dyspogenic disease, stenosis, and radiculopathy. She had a bad back, and in order to go into surgery, that would require an extensive surgical procedure in the lumbar spine. It would require a fusion of three levels. It would require steroid injections. Well, they probably wouldn't have helped.
Well,
that's a decision that she made with her doctors. You know, that was discussed, but she decided not to have that done because it probably wouldn't have helped. This is a bad back, Your Honors, and that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with a little bulging disc or a little this or a little that. This is a bad back that really started in 3 years before she came to file her complaint. Since 2015, she's had a bad back. And there was an MRI back in 2015 that showed two levels of deterioration. 3 years later, in 2018, that had increased to three levels because this was a progressive